Is there a particular verse? Or? Is there a no particular verse? Or? Round and round she goes. What's that?
No particular verse.
So we'll do a general verse.
How about your favorite one?
Oh, I think the whole book. Oh, okay, here's an interesting verse. Just happened to find an interesting verse. So for those who are new or who have amnesia, we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Hey, Braja. This is Bhagavad Gita as it is, presented by our spiritual leader of our movement, Srila Prabhupada. We're reading from Bhagavad Gita, which is the good book of Krishna consciousness, and chapter 15, text 19, where Krishna says, first Sanskrit, Jomam evam asamudho janati purushottamang sa sarvavid bhajati mang sarvabhavena bharata. Translation, whoever knows me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, without doubting, is the knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in full devotional service to me, O son of Bharata, Arjun. Prabhupada's purport, there are many philosophical speculations about the constitutional position of the living entities and the Supreme Absolute Truth. Now in this verse, the Supreme Personality of Godhead clearly explains that anyone who knows Lord Krishna to be the Supreme Person actually knows everything. The imperfect knower goes on simply speculating about the Absolute Truth, but the perfect knower, not wasting his valuable time, engages directly in Krishna consciousness, the devotional service of the Supreme Lord. Throughout the whole of Bhagavad Gita, this fact is being stressed at every step. And still there are so many stubborn commentators on Bhagavad Gita who consider the Supreme Absolute Truth and the living entities to be one and the same. Monism. Vedic knowledge is called Shruti, learning by oral reception. One should actually receive the Vedic message from authorities like Krishna and his representatives. Here, Krishna distinguishes everything very nicely, and one should hear from this source. Simply to hear like the hogs is not sufficient. In other words, hearing the physical sound, but not hearing with understanding. Not hearing with understanding. Compared here to hearing like the hogs. Simply to hear like the hogs is not sufficient. One must be able to understand from the authorities. It is not that one should simply speculate academically. One should submissively hear from Bhagavad Gita that these living entities are always subordinate to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anyone able to understand this, according to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, knows the purpose of the Vedas. No one else knows the purpose of the Vedas. The word bhajati is very significant. In many places, the word bhajati is expressed in relationship with service to the Supreme Lord. If a person engages in full Krishna consciousness in the devotional service of the Lord, it is understood that he has understood all of Vedic knowledge. In the Vaishnava parampara, it is said that if one is engaged in Krishna's devotional service, then there is no need for any other spiritual process for understanding the Supreme Absolute Truth, because that person has already come to the point being engaged in the Lord's devotional service. He has ended all preliminary processes of understanding, but if anyone, after speculating for hundreds of thousands of lives, which is a long time, after speculating for hundreds of thousands of lives, if one does not come to the point that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and that one has to surrender there, all one's speculations for so many years and lives is a useless waste of time. Well, tell it like it is. This is very straight talk from the pure devotee. So, Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Priestaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste, Sarasvate, Devi, Gauravani, Pracharini, Nirvishay, Shunyavadi, Paschatyade, Chitarini. This verse occurs, of course, within a context. It is a text within a context. Con, con. You know, in Spanish means with, together. And so every text, or this text, appears with other texts. And so all the texts together, of course, is called the context. And Prabhupada here in his purport is emphasizing speaking strongly against monism. Monism. Which means oneism. Mono, one. The idea that there's only one ultimate reality and that our individual existence is not permanent, is not a permanent fact. And that the difference between ourselves and God is only an appearance, and that actually everything is, there's simply one impersonal spiritual reality. Shankara taught something like this. There was an old song, "When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore." Remember that? I don't know if that's ever been quoted in a Gaudiya Vaishnava lecture. But anyway, so basically the reason I bring this up is because Shankara's philosophy is basically, when Maya hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's diversity. The idea is that we are individual. The idea is that when the absolute or the soul or Brahman, literally when illusion hits our consciousness, then we begin to see there are many things in the world. It's almost like, let's say, if there's some water on your windshield or something while you're driving, then you start to see, when you see the lights coming at you, you see the lights split up into many parts. And so the idea is that that consciousness, when it passes through an illusion, sees diversity. Anyway, I don't want to get too technical about this because it's actually not such a great idea. For one thing, and there's all kinds of problems with this. First of all, if there's only one reality, which is Brahman, there's no second thing, then how could there be illusion? And Shankar and later his followers have spent centuries trying to explain this, and no one's really satisfied yet. So, because obviously there's at least two things, knowledge and illusion, and then if one soul becomes enlightened, why aren't all souls enlightened? Because all souls are really the same soul. So either we have a case of a sort of a horrendous instance of split personalities type of... what do they call that? What's that clinical? Schizophrenia. Sort of like this unbelievable case of like cosmic schizophrenia, where one soul thinks that it is trillions of souls. So, but anyway, if the reality is that we are one soul, when one soul is enlightened, then there wouldn't be anyone not enlightened, because everyone is the same thing. It's not a great idea. And there's a reason why people who teach monism at a certain point kind of run out of philosophical gas and resort to that old dirty trick: it can't be explained in words. So, interestingly, the people that claim that the truth can't be explained in words usually write more books than anyone else. That was even pointed out, by the way, when I was when I was younger than I am now. In the 1960s, late 60s, when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, I had a young German professor teaching a course on contemporary German literature, and in that course we read Siddhartha. And in that book, Hermann Hesse has Siddhartha, the Buddha, saying that the truth can't be spoken in words, and the professor was kind of mocking this, because he said that, yeah, he says this with words on page 20, and he also says it on page 33. In other words, it's like never say never, the obvious contradiction. So in any case, Krishna here, apart from the obvious fallacies in any attempt to deny the reality of variety, or the reality of oneness. I mean, it's also the fact is that there is a real sense in which we are all one. I mean, if you think, for example, to give a mundane example, one that's given by the Acharyas, imagine when two people fall in love, or believe they have fallen in love. Obviously, as a sannyasi, I must maintain a certain skepticism about this. Anyway, imagine two people that believe they have fallen deeply in love. So, before this happened, you have, let's be old-fashioned, talk about a boy and a girl. So, before they fall in love, this is an individual boy, and this is an individual girl. So they're obviously two different people. Then after they fall in love, in one sense, they're still individuals, but in another sense, there is a third reality. There was a boy, there was a girl, now there is a third reality, which is a couple. And so the couple, it's a singular word, a couple, one couple. And so there's a sense in which the couple is a new and third reality. Now, if you consider relationships, if the two people literally lose their individual identity, this is called codependence, which is a problem. Codependence, where the people lose their sense of individual integrity, lose their sense of individuality, and really have no true identity outside their dependence on the other person. That's going too far in terms of oneness. And if, on the other hand, this couple, they don't really talk to each other that much, and they don't agree, they get to a point where they don't agree on very many things, except they agree to disagree on everything. But they don't want to pay their own rent, so they stay together or something. Obviously, if the people are too separate, if there's no real sense of oneness between these people, then it's also not a healthy relationship. And so if you consider, even psychologically, what a healthy relationship is, it's a combination of oneness and difference, individuality. And also the same is true for normal, sane cognition. For example, in this room right now, in order for you to be a sane human being conscious of what's going on here, you have to be able to perform two functions, which in Sanskrit are called vyasa and samasa. Asa means to place, and so vyasa means to place apart, and samasa means to place together. Vyasa, by the way, is actually a title of Dvaipayana. The person's name is actually Dvaipayana, and he's called Vyas. That's actually his title, the editor or the divider. So anyway, in this room right now, you have to be able to perceive the different individual objects, such as the chandeliers, the fans, the walls, the floor. If you can't tell the difference between the floor and the wall, or between the person next to you and the clock, you need help. So you have to be able to, we distinguish between the different parts of our own body. When we sing, the songs we sing here, there are different words. The words have different sounds in them, and so on. There are melodies. Melodies, of course, are pleasing, well, good melodies, are pleasing ratios between sounds, and different tones. So, in order to be a sane human being, you have to be able to perform this function. You have to be able to distinguish between yourself and others, different parts of your own body, the different sounds of a word, different words, different grammatical relationships between words, up and down, sideways, what's the door, what's the window. You have to be able to distinguish all these things. At the same time, you have to be able to put it all back together into one coherent experience, namely, we're sitting here doing a class. And that is a single, integrated experience. It's one thing. And yet there's so many different components. So normal, if you think about one and different, this is the ultimately, this is the ontology of our movement. Ontology means philosophy of existence, the nature of existence. If you look at Indian intellectual history, which focused on the interpretation of sacred texts, such as the Gyanakanda portion of the Vedas, the Upanishads, Indian intellectual history, there were basically six different Vedic philosophies, and which are called Vedic philosophies. And then there were philosophies outside the Vedic culture, the philosophies that rejected the Vedas, such as Buddhism and Jainism. Never mind those for now. That's another interesting thing. But in terms of people who remain faithful to the original culture and the original wisdom of that culture and tried to understand the Vedas, there were six different approaches. Among those six, the big winner ultimately was Vedanta. Vedanta was one of those six, and ultimately it really predominated, and the other ones became sort of footnotes. And if you look at Vedanta, the word Vedanta, we associate it with the Vedanta Sutras, also called the Brahma Sutras. Ultimately, Vedanta is the apparatus, in other words, the literature which formed the foundation of the attempt to philosophically understand the absolute truth, were three. There were three literatures that together were considered to be Vedanta. One is the Brahma Sutras, which we also call the Vedanta Sutras. Also the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. So ultimately the Brahma Sutras were an explanation of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are called Shruti Prasthan, or a point of departure from Shruti, from the original Vedic literature. The Brahma Sutras were called Nyaya Prasthan. In other words, Prasthan means a point of departure, punto de partida, and from logic, because it's a logical interpretation of the Upanishads, and the Bhagavad Gita was called Smriti Prasthan, but ultimately spoken by God himself, it's the most important book. So anyway, if you look at the great Vedanta tradition, ultimately, although they discussed epistemology, how do you know, how do you get valid knowledge, ultimately, the real battleground, the real issue that occupied most of the attention of the great philosophers in Indian history was ontology, which is the nature of existence. What are the fundamental real things in the world? And ultimately, there was some agreement that God is a real thing, and that souls really exist, and also that the world somehow exists. And then the question was, how do these things exist? What is the relationship? Is one just an illusory appearance of the other? In other words, are individual souls simply the illusory appearance of one absolute truth? Or are individual souls fundamentally real? What about nature? Is nature simply an illusion? Or is it also real? And if so, how is it real? So anyway, in discussing these things, ultimately the obvious truth of the matter is that God and souls and nature are simultaneously one and different. This is the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. It was actually also the teaching of many classical philosophers in Greco-Roman civilization, and it was also the teaching of other Vedantists, actually before Lord Chaitanya. But Lord Chaitanya confirmed this is actually the proper understanding, that we as individual souls are one with God, and at the same time, we are different. It's just like any healthy relationship. Two people, let's say you have a loving relationship, are one, but they're also different. It's exactly like the nature of sane cognition. In order for you to be sanely conscious of what's going on here, you have to see both the differences between people and directions and words, and you also have to put it all together into a single, coherent, integrated experience. It's just someone speaking in the temple room. And so one and different is not simply an intellectual interpretation of some old Sanskrit literatures. It's the nature of reality itself. It is actually the nature of all reality. For example, if you study ancient Greek philosophy, one of the issues that really got to these people, the ancient Greeks, was the relationship between the individual and the category. Anyway, I mean, I won't go into all of Plato and Aristotle, but they really stayed up late at night worrying about this. So to give a typical example that would have kept Plato and Aristotle up at night, consider horses. I mean, there's a category horse. So if you say the horse is a noble, the horse is a handsome creature. So when you say the horse, the category, you don't mean any particular horse, but just horses. And so, in other words, there's a sense in which every horse belongs to the category of horse. And yet there's a sense in which every horse is a unique individual horse. The oneness is real, and the uniqueness is real. To say that this particular horse is unique is a true statement. To say that this unique horse is at the same time fully a member of the category horse and is therefore, in a sense, one with every other horse, because they're all horses, is also a true statement. It's also a true statement. Anyway, we could go on and on like this, but suffice it to say that if you seriously look at the world, if you look at psychology, ontology, if you just look at the nature of reality, the obvious fact is that the things of this world are simultaneously one and different, and that's also the relationship between ourselves and God. Prabhupada is emphasizing this because this is the part of the Gita where Krishna himself emphasizes it, and I'll just wrap up by explaining that. It comes at the end of chapter 15, very interesting chapter of the Gita. Actually, so many interesting things here in the Gita that, but you got to stop somewhere. Yes, Krishna, in chapter 15, text 16, Krishna begins a new paragraph. There are really paragraphs in the Bhagavad Gita. They're not, you don't see them visually in our books. But there are paragraphs. And so Krishna begins a new paragraph, a new subtopic at 15.16, where he says, Dvavi mao purushau loke ksharas kshaksharaiva cha ksharak sarvani bhutani kutasto ksharaiva cha. I'm sorry, kutasto kshara uchate. Krishna says there are these two kinds of souls in the world. There are these two souls in the world, which Prabhupada translates the fallible and the infallible. Krishna says literally the perishing and the unperishing, or the fallible and the unfallible. There are these two souls in the world. And Krishna says that all creatures are fallible or perishing because all creatures, practically, almost all creatures, have adopted a false identity, taking the body to be the self. And so forth, and therefore that persona, if you think of the word not person, but persona. Persona means an identity which a person can temporarily adopt. So the persona, the identity which we have now adopted will perish. Whether the identity is American or Timbuktuvian or male or female or, you know, whatever. Whatever kind of body you got this time around. That identity is temporary. However, Krishna says, kutastha, literally the one who stands at the peak. The one who stands at the peak, literally. Prabhupada translates here in oneness. The kutastha is unperishing. The kutastha is, because, in other words, the one who stands at the peak of understanding, the one who is enlightened, has discovered his or her eternal identity. Now, Krishna goes on to say, having established that there are these two kinds of souls, not two kinds of souls, but really souls in two different conditions. Krishna then says, Uttama Purushas Tuanya. However, Krishna says, however, the Supreme Person is someone else. In other words, there are liberated souls, there are conditioned souls, there are enlightened souls, there are ignorant souls, but the Supreme Soul, or the Supreme Person, is someone else. It's neither of these two. It's quite clear. And Krishna says, and that Supreme Soul is declared to be the, well, or that is declared to be the Paramatma, the highest soul, the one who pervades the universe and maintains it, the unperishing Lord, the unperishing Lord. Then Krishna says, Jasmat, which means because, Jasmat Kshara Titoham, because it is I who am beyond the fallible soul, and even beyond the infallible soul, even beyond the liberated, enlightened soul. Aksharada Pichotama, Atosmi, therefore, Atosmi Loke Vede Cha Pratita Purushottama, therefore, I am celebrated in the world and in the Veda as that Supreme Person. And then Krishna says, the verse we read today, one who thus knows me, without confusion, as the Supreme Person, that one knows everything and worships me with all their heart, with all their existence. So Krishna has made this point very clearly, and then someone may doubt, well, that's just the Bhagavad Gita. Then Krishna says, Hiti Guyatamang Shastram, this is the most advanced scripture. This is the most advanced scripture. Iti guyatamang shastram idam uktang mayanaga, which I've today spoken to you, etad buddha buddhiman syat, one who understands this actually has understanding and has done their real duty. So this is a very beautiful part of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is very explicitly rejecting the preposterous idea that we are God. If we are God, we really have to, radically change the definition of God. So, and then Prabhupada explains that in the purport. So, any questions on these points? Yes. Very good point. Mayavadis also get out of the way when horses are coming. So interestingly, Shankara did not say the world doesn't exist. Shankara, it's interesting because it's often the case, as we've seen even close to home, that the followers of a great leader, some of the followers of a great leader, will be even more radical or more severe on certain points than even their teacher. And this was actually the case with Buddha. Interestingly, this is the point I always make, that when Buddha first began his preaching career in Benares, or near Benares, in a deer park, sort of, I guess it was kind of one of the original ancient petting zoos or something. But anyway, the second sermon that he gave is called the Sermon or the Lecture on the Non-Existence of the Self. And what's interesting is he doesn't say the self doesn't exist. So the followers, or at least some of the followers of Buddha, went way beyond their teacher in denying the existence of an individual self. In the same way, it's known by scholars that followers of Shankara went beyond their teacher in insisting on the irreality of the world. The world's not real. So Shankara, of course, is considered, even by academics, as a closet Vaishnav. Because, of course, he wrote his Gita Mahatmya, in which he just very devotedly worships Krishna as the Supreme Lord. And although Shankara says that even, or his followers said, even categories like Ishwar, the Lord, ultimately are illusory, but they're useful for now, Shankara shows real devotion And how could he really be so devoted to an illusion if he's an enlightened person? And also, Shankar didn't deny the world is real. Shankar admits that the world is really here. He doesn't say the world isn't here. He simply says we don't see it properly. We're not seeing it properly. We're mistaking it. We're taking it for something else, but it's actually here. So the idea that actually neither the Buddhists nor the impersonalists say the world is not here, that's an idea which I think only exists among us, that they think that. In fact, the Buddhists, for example, explicitly rejected the idea of nihilism, which means that nothing exists, or the world doesn't exist. So Shankar accepts the world is here. He's simply saying we're not seeing it properly. And then if we see it properly, we'll see that actually everything is Brahman. Now, because everyone, practically, sees the world is here, and everyone, based on the belief that there's a real world here, is functioning, and that those who assume there is not real variety become dysfunctional. So all practical experience is on the side of those who believe the variety is real. 100% of practical experience, if you assume the variety is really there, life always works out better. In fact, you would be totally dysfunctional unless, and even the impersonalists knew this. So therefore, even if they want to hold some bizarre, totally undemonstrable theory that ultimately it's all an illusion, they themselves accept that in order to function in the world, you have to accept it as real. And therefore, it turns out, in order to be functional in this world, you have to accept the one indifference, the oneness indifference. And it seems to me the burden is on them. If all practical activity, all practical perception, everything about the real practical world shows variety, if someone wants to deny what everyone can see is really there, if someone wants to deny which every functional person in the world accepts as true, they take the burden on themselves. So, you see what I mean? It's not like, and ultimately, it's really, these kinds of theories really came from monasteries where you had celibate monks with too much time in their hands, and they just got into these very sort of technical, very extremely mental ideas which have nothing to do with the real world. It really is a bunch of monks with too much time on their hands coming up with just very mental, very impractical ideas that they themselves did not follow in their real lives. Yes, back there? Well, I think that it is relevant in this sense. If you look at the New Age movement, we're allowed to use that term. Just as, I think it was the first Newtonian principle, every action causes an equal and opposite reaction. Third law of Newton. Anyway, one of the first few laws of Newton was that... So I want to talk about that. So just hold that in your mind, that principle. And there's a type of Newtonian cultural physics. And then consider the psychological tendency of what's called post-traumatic stress disorder, which I'm sure you've dealt with in your professional career. First of all, post-traumatic means that after a traumatic event, which can be, you know, a terrible accident, witnessing a terrible crime, combat, just all kinds of, you know, things that just shock the human mind. And then post-traumatic, after that, there's a stress disorder. There's a continuing anxiety. And interestingly, two of the main symptoms of this PTSD are hypervigilance and withdrawal. Because someone who's been shocked like that, they become hypervigilant. They're really on guard because they're afraid they're going to become traumatized again. And because of that fear, they also withdraw from things. And so you can see that in relationships. People who have had very bad, even traumatic experiences in relationships become hypervigilant and they tend to back away from relationships. And so a point I want to make here is that if you study the history of Western civilization, you know, because that's where we are right now, I think it's absolutely obvious, it's absolutely irrefutable that the religious history of Western civilization has been deeply, profoundly traumatic. I mean, the experience of walking out the door of your house and seeing one of your neighbors being burned alive because of sort of relatively subtle theological mistakes. I mean the sheer quantity of violence, the amount of persecution, decades after Newton, there were scholars in the best universities in Europe writing learned articles on how to recognize the true witch so you don't burn the wrong woman. I mean, the Inquisitions, where you had many of the most clever minds in Europe, if not the wisest, employed full-time thinking up the absolutely most excruciating, horrific ways to kill someone so they don't die too soon, but they suffer the maximum amount of pain in the most horrible ways. And so, I mean, you can go on and on and on. So the religious history, you know, we go on all day about the history. The history of Western religion is severely traumatic. And so my take is, and this sort of will get back, coming around the bend to your question, that Western civilization, at least educated Western civilization, you know, not the born-again medieval types among us, but educated and in the old-fashioned sense of the word, if we can still use it, liberal, in the old-fashioned, you know, the educated liberal tradition of Erasmus, not of, you know, whatever. So, you can see that there is actually this post-traumatic stress disorder at a societal level. And so in Western civilization, because even apart from the past, the experience of just meeting people every day who are the most really stupid, vulgar, nasty people in the world, in the name of God, who tell other people that, you know, that all of your sacred beliefs are not only wrong, they're evil, and that anyone that shares your sacred beliefs will be, God will torture them forever because everything you hold sacred is evil. I mean, this itself is evil. The idea that God is such an evil, psychotic fiend, that God will torture his own children forever for mental crimes, subtle theological mistakes, is itself evil. In other words, this fanatical teaching is not only wrong, it is itself evil because it portrays God as evil. Because any father or mother that would torture their own children simply for some philosophical disagreement, that parent would be evil, would be an evil fiend. And so to depict God as evil is itself evil. And so because we have this evil, false teaching going on, and when they could do it, when they could get away with it, they murdered people over it. They just can't get away with it anymore. I think much to their disappointment. So therefore, there's been a response. There has been a response where people have gone to the other extreme. It's like the Newtonian principle. And because the, let's say, fanatical Christian teaching, and there are many good Christians. In fact, most Christians in America don't believe that people of other religions go to hell now. But at least those who still hold these evil views, and they are evil, because they are over-specific. Their definition of who receives the grace of God is over-specific. Like you have to belong to a particular denomination or a particular religion, and therefore the reaction has been over-general, to oppose, to passionately oppose any specification. That anything anybody wants to worship is fine, and that as soon as you try to in any way specify, as soon as you try to in any way compromise the sort of meaningless generality of God, then you threaten society. And so, or you threaten real spirituality. And so this is hypervigilant. This is one of the symptoms. So, in other words, so-called liberal, educated people in this civilization are actually suffering from a type of PTSD, where they're hypervigilant. They think that any specification related to God is actually puts us in danger of going back to the Middle Ages, Crusades, Inquisitions, burnings, and everything. And so they're hypervigilant, and they withdraw from anything that looks like a specific religious doctrine. And therefore, in order to, and because of this, I think, actually disturbed position they're in, therefore, they often promote the idea that God is one, or it's all one, or that or we ourselves can be God. And they oppose any specification, any definition, any rule, any principle. And so in that sense, I think there is some relevance to these old debates. What I tell people ask, like, what's your position? I always answer that our position is principled inclusivism. That we are inclusive, but based on reasonable principles. So that, for example, if you say that, okay, whatever you believe is right for you, what if I believe that I should kill everyone that doesn't agree with me? Is that right for me? So people that say that, you know, whatever anyone believes is true for them, they don't really believe that. They don't really believe that. So our position is principled inclusivism. On the basis of reasonable principles, we are inclusive. And on the two extremes, you have these dogmatic fanatics. The dogmatic, let's say, Christians, just to give a thing its real name, who say that this is the only way and there's no other way to God. And they have produced their equal and opposite reaction. Dogmatic metaphysical relativism. People that hold as a dogmatic, unreasoning, dogmatic principle that all the different views in God, about God are relative. And none of them can be more true than any other. And they hold that view not on the basis of a serious study of world religions. They hold this view a priori as a dogma. And they believe it's an antidote to their opposite. And so this reactionary, dogmatic spiritual relativism is just as fanatical as its opposite, because it's the opposite reaction. So it's actually Krishna consciousness which is bringing the historical dialectic to the higher stage, because you have a thesis, which is fanatical religion, you have the antithesis, which is fanatical relativity of religions, and the synthesis is precisely this principled inclusivism. Well, we do have objective principles. It's not everything goes, or anything goes. But on the same time, we hold they're based on reasonable principles. We're inclusive. We're inclusive based on reasonable principles. So, anyway. Yes?
I want to ask a question for my friend from L.A.
Friend from L.A.
Yeah, right here, Joshua.
Hey, Joshua. I'm from L.A. too. Yes?
We spent at a Buddhist camp for a couple of weeks.
Yes. Well, they're not an incarnation of each other.
Okay, explain it. And also, why do they teach different things?
Why do they teach different things?
Yeah, because like in the book...
3 minutes or less? Okay. I'll give you the real short version of this, because someone may be getting hungry. Buddha himself is an incarnation of Krishna, not vice versa. Buddha taught in a particular way at a certain time in history because that's what was needed historically. Basically, India was out of control 2,500 years ago. Innumerable animals were being slaughtered in the name of Vedic sacrifice. So Buddha just stopped it. He stopped the Vedic sacrifices, denied their authority, and he stressed ethical principles and metaphysical psychology. Buddha, the interesting thing is that Buddha actually did not teach an ontology. In other words, Buddha did not teach, this is the nature of the soul, this is the nature of God, or this is the nature of the universe. He wasn't teaching metaphysics, he was teaching psychology. And therefore he said that never mind those things, if you meditate in a particular way, accept these principles, you will come to a higher state of consciousness and become a moral person. And eventually you'll be liberated. So Buddha taught a metaphysical psychology, not an ontology. Later his followers, in order to compete in the very fast lane Vedanta circles where people were discussing, they came up with metaphysics. Even in ancient times in India, there were many Buddhists who believed that there is a soul or something like a person. It was called Pudgalavada. It no longer exists, but there were many Buddhists who argued that this is absurd to say there's no soul. Many Buddhists argue this. It's absurd to say there's no soul because who gets the karma? We all believe in karma. And if there's no soul, why do I have to be a good person? Because I'm not a person, so why be a good person? And in the most popular stories of Buddhism, the Jataka stories, the stories of the previous births of the Buddha, Buddha, 100 lives ago was this. Some guy did all these pious things and he took this birth and that birth. And it's Buddha. It's the same person. And you start to get Buddhas who are omniscient beings that live in paradise. In other words, look suspiciously like gods. Finally, without going through the whole history of Buddhism, the big winner in Buddhist history was the Mahayana movement. And today, 85% or more of all the living Buddhists in the world belong to the Mahayana division of Buddhism. And they teach that the perfection of Buddhism is to become a bodhisattva, which means a compassionate, loving person who forsakes his or her own liberation in order to come back to this world, life after life, to lovingly, compassionately help other persons. So it's just like that clown, you punch it and it pops back up. So personal existence, the fact that we are individual persons. In India, in Buddhism, and in the followers of Shankara, we find perhaps the most philosophically sophisticated and the most monastically practiced, sophisticated attempts in history to knock down this idea of a personal soul and even of a personal deity. And it bounced right back up. And it turns out that almost all Buddhists today worship saints, angels, bodhisattvas, aspire to go to a paradise, some kind of heaven, pray for mercy, are very concerned about the souls of their ancestors and their children. In other words, generic old-time religion. And if you look at impersonalism, again, it's sort of a nice topic when you're sitting around the monastery and sipping some herbal tea or something. But in the real world, no one's really doing it. In the real world, everybody is acting like a person and everyone is trying to get mercy. Even Shankara himself devoted himself to Krishna. So in the real world, religion keeps coming back to this. You're an individual soul and you have to surrender to a personal deity. It always comes back to that. And it came back to that in Buddhism. Yes? Very short version. There is a spiritual bhakti movement within Islam called the Sufi movement, which was very similar to, it was a bhakti movement that had paramparas and gurus and sampradayas, and you worship the samadhi of the guru, and it was very much a bhakti movement that it has been at different times persecuted by more fanatical, crazy people claiming to be Muslims. But actually, in the Islamic tradition, there is a very powerful spiritual bhakti movement which was highly influenced in India by the Vaishnav movements. They're the good guys. Yes? All right. Sounds like a movie or something.
How many windows is there in the United Nations building?
Yeah. To know everything basically means to know tattvas. The tattvas, the fundamental real things that exist, such as jiva tattva, Vishnu tattva, Prakriti tattva. So to know the real nature of everything. I may not know how many windows are in the United Nations building, but I know what those windows really are. They're the external energy of Krishna. And therefore I do know them. And so it's to know the nature of everything, to know the ultimate identity of everything, not simply all the details. Yes? Yeah. Two for the price of one. I cannot confirm or deny that. Yes. Yeah. We have equal access to Prabhupada's founder, Acharya. We see that many people who personally associate with Prabhupada went over the moon or somewhere. And we see that many people who did not physically associate with Prabhupada, love him very much, and have completely devoted their lives to him. And so, again, Prabhupada emphasized to me, personally, one time I went into his room in Mayapur, offered obeisances, and as soon as I sat up, he said, "This personal association is not so important." So I just went down again and left and went out to serve. And so, Prabhupada also said that when you're looking at the external form of the guru, you're not actually seeing the guru. We compared it to the clouds sailing past the moon, and we think the moon is moving through the clouds. And so Prabhupada is an eternally liberated pure devotee of Krishna who, to some extent, manifested himself through an external form, but is certainly not limited by that. And therefore, Prabhupada emphasized that he is the founder Acharya of ISKCON. He's the founder Acharya of ISKCON, and anyone, and every member of ISKCON, anyone who serves this movement has an equal access to Prabhupada as a founder Acharya. Diksha Guru. Diksha Guru is just a detail. Prabhupada says in chapter 6 of the Nectar Devotion that the duty of a devotee is to follow in the footsteps of the great Acharyas under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. So hopefully there will be thousands and millions of bona fide spiritual masters, as Prabhupada fervently desired. But the great Acharya, as Prabhupada said, the whole Vedic civilization comes down under the guidance of the great Acharyas. So all of us are serving Prabhupada as the great Acharya. Now obviously, just like in a family, the parents teach their children. The older children teach the younger children. Older devotees teach younger devotees. I mean, it's just natural that within a society, those who know more teach those who know less. Those who are more experienced, whether it's teaching someone how to ride a bike or how to go back to Godhead. And so one who is a little more experienced may be called a guru. And the one who's learning is a shisha, the student. It's just teacher and student. Every one of us in certain situations is a guru. And every one of us in certain situations is a student. So there are millions of teacher-student relationships in ISKCON. But there is one founder, Acharya, and that's Prabhupada. And that's the position he claimed for himself. Prabhupada emphasized to me that the most intimate association with the pure devotee comes through service, even service and separation. He said there is service, he said there is, you know, you can serve the vani or the vapu, serve the message or the body, and he emphasized the service to the vani, serving Prabhupada's message, is the higher service. And since Krishna is non-different from devotional service, and Prabhupada is non-different from service to him, therefore, it is in the act of serving Prabhupada that we associate with him, and the highest service is in separation, service to his message. Prabhupada made these points very clear. He didn't want to start a personality cult. He didn't just want to, you know, tell us to just, you know, spend the rest of our lives just telling sentimental anecdotes. Although the anecdotes are wonderful, and I've got my own to tell. But Prabhupada emphasized that we actually have to go out and serve his mission. Prabhupada himself, and I was just thinking myself, because I've got to make decisions in my own life for various reasons. You know, we come to forks in the road at different points, and, you know, I've decided, you know, not to take up smoking. You'll be happy to hear, but just kidding. But anyway, I've got to make decisions in my own life, and I was just thinking today how Prabhupada got on the boat. Like, how many Jaladutas have we gotten on lately? You know, just like the Christians say everyone has to bear his cross, everyone's got to board his Jaladuta. Prabhupada had a vision. Prabhupada had a dream. I mean, what were the material odds that this elderly person could just get on this boat and land, you know, and end up in the cultural center of the galaxy, Butler, Pennsylvania, and save the world? Like, I know how to save the world. I'll go on a cargo ship to Butler, Pennsylvania. So, but Prabhupada had this dream. And so he had the guts, he had the courage, he had the faith to get on the boat. And I have my dreams, you know, and we can really, what do they say, paralysis by analysis, we can kind of think about it. No, that could never happen. I could never do that. That's impossible. And we can sort of, you know, just extinguish our own dreams. Of course, we can also become, you know, hopelessly impractical. So Prabhupada was a little practical, but we have to have the courage to really try to do something wonderful. Prabhupada once said to us, I was in his garden one time, we were at his feet, and Prabhupada said to us in L.A., what is the use of your being Americans if you don't do something wonderful? What is the use of it if you don't do something wonderful? That also applies, by the way, to those of you who have green cards. So... So Prabhupada thought it was absurd, this like sort of like this obsession with some type of hierarchical pecking order. Like, well, I joined the movement 3 weeks before you did, but yeah, but I'm so-and-so's disciple, but you're... Prabhupada wanted to know who's going to get off their asana and go out and do the real work. And whoever's going to do it, Prabhupada will embrace that person. That person will actually know Prabhupada. Whoever's willing to go out and really give their life to Prabhupada, give up selfishness. Because we are all selfish. We are all selfish creatures. And those who are willing to give up their own selfishness and go out and dedicate their lives to Prabhupada, they will see Prabhupada face to face. Yes. He's my Diksha Guru, and he's everyone's founder Acharya. And when Prabhupada introduced himself, he didn't say in formal letters to government leaders or to foundations, allow me to introduce myself, I'm the Diksha Guru of ISKCON. He said, allow me to introduce myself, I'm the founder Acharya of ISKCON. That was the unique title that Prabhupada claimed for himself. Prabhupada was not a jealous god. Prabhupada loved us more than anyone could ever love us, and Prabhupada's most fervent hope was that we would all excel and become glorious and conquer the world in his mission. But the one title he claimed for himself, which he would not share, was that he was the founder of Acharya, which means that all of our glory has to come by serving his feet within ISKCON. So we'll end here. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.